Hey everybody, Kevin Rose here. Welcome back to another episode of The Kevin Rose Show. Today's show is going to be a fun one because it really addresses a problem that I had and actually still continue to have, and that is getting to know people. For me, being a geek and really being on my computer for most of my youth, I didn't really have a lot of outside exposure to humans. I really just sat on my computer all day long, and that was kind of like my best friend, sadly enough. One of the things that I had a hard time with as I was getting older was making connections with people. And I don't mean that in kind of a networking type of way, like business connections. That is really important, and it's certainly something that we should have in our toolkit. But just that initial conversation and getting through those layers of small talk and to real meaningful conversation with people so that you can actually get to know them and find new friends, I think is a really useful skill to have. And for me, it was difficult because I'm the kind of person that likes to jump into a bit of the meaty conversation right away. I hate that kind of like, oh, it's cold out today, you know, that small talk that you have at parties and whatnot. And so, you know, I've always been a little bit shy when it comes to that stuff. You know, I'm kind of the first person that when you show up at a party or a get together, I head on over to the bar to grab a glass of wine because, you know, it kind of like social lubricant a little bit, makes you a little bit more relaxed so you can have these conversations. The guest today that we're having on, Jordan Harbinger, he was the same way. He had a really hard time getting to know people and meet people, and he figured out some really helpful tips and tricks to get past these issues, become a deeper connector with people, better networker, get rid of this kind of social anxiety that you have, and really form kind of lasting relationships with folks. And so Jordan is the host of a podcast called The Art of Charm, which is, if you haven't listened to it, it's absolutely massive. I mean, he has hundreds of thousands of people that listen to this podcast, and he has some really good tools that we can use in everyday life to help with this side of, you know, being a little geekier, being a little shy. And so we dig into how he got started, what he did, which is just absolutely hilarious to get past some of his anxiety around this stuff. So it's going to be a fun episode. You'll learn a lot, and I hope you enjoy it. But before we get started, I wanted to tell you, just head on over to kevinrose.com. That's my website. You can see all of my previous episodes, including some of my cryptocurrency stuff, which I'm getting into more. I might carve off a separate show for cryptocurrency if it becomes too much. You'll see them intertwined here every few episodes on this show. But you can head on over there, and if you want to get notified of all the stuff that I'm checking out, the different podcasts that I'm doing, the cool like links and videos that I'm finding throughout the month, you want to sign up for my newsletter. And I typically send that out just once a month. Every once in a while, I'll do a little emergency update if there's something really cool you should check out. But the first day of every month, a new episode goes out. KevinRose.com, click on the newsletter tab, put in your email address there, and you will be all signed up. So that is it. Let's jump into the episode with Jordan Harbinger. So 11 years.
Yeah.
As of yesterday.
Yeah.
I think that one, that's amazing that anyone's been podcasting that long, because I was doing Dignation back in 2005, I guess. But we couldn't keep it up that long. How did you, well, first of all, to step back for my fans that don't know who you are, like, what is your show about? How'd you get started?
What the show is about is essentially we take high performers like CIA agents, FBI, and they'll train us how to read body language, or somebody who's maybe a really good talk show host like Larry King. And I'll say, what's the key to having an in-depth conversation, or what's the key to relating to somebody who's got vastly different life experiences? And then I try to break down what they have done over their career and into practical sound bites that can be applied by the listener right away. So mm-hmm. instead of just like, wow, that was so inspirational, I want somebody who's like, oh, okay, this is how I network better, or this is how I exhibit more confident nonverbal communication that I got from the head of the FBI spy recruiter, or this Russian defector, or this KGB guy, or, you know, an entrepreneur or something like that. And so The Art of Charm is essentially a school that teaches that type of philosophy, or that type of, in fact, not philosophy, that type of practical outcome. And it got started because when I was, I'm a lawyer by trade, or I was anyway. I'm still a member of the Bar Association, so I'm still an attorney. But I was working on Wall Street. And before that, I was in high school, and like you, I was like, oh, I can teach myself geometry on the geometry test. And then I got to college and everybody was pretty smart. And so I could no longer just rely on figuring it out as I went, because everybody was doing that. But what everybody was also doing was drinking their face off.
Yeah.
So I just was able to outwork everybody and stay focused. Same thing with law school. Then I got to Wall Street, where everybody was smart, everybody was focused, everybody was a hard worker. And these are people that are way smarter than me, much smarter than me, just as hard of a worker. Some of them have tips and tricks and focus that I never imagined, you know, 20 hours a day of focus. Whereas I'm like, I don't know, 50% focus. I mean, superhuman levels of input and output from these people. And yeah. I thought, I'm going to get fired. And you probably know this as imposter syndrome, where you think, oh, I'm not good enough to be here. Somebody's going to figure out that I'm
discover that I'm not. Yeah.
A fraud. I'm the weak link. And so my idea, I'd heard this story about this gal who hated being an attorney, and this is a big law firm. And so what she did was she just decided to like stop showing up, and she would work from home. And I put that in air quotes for those of you who yeah. can't tell a verbal air quote. And so she was working from home, but she was also reading a lot of novels and just not being very productive. And it took them like 4 years to fire her.
Wow.
And I thought, wait a minute. If I work from home and I work hard, maybe it'll take them like 8 years to right. fire me. So I could have a whole career here and they wouldn't even know that I'm not supposed to be here and that they shouldn't have hired me and that I'm not smart or all these other sort of insecurities that I had rolling around in my head. And so I finally asked one of these partners who was never in the office and I figured must be working from home all the time. I said, hey, Dave, how come you're never in the office, but you're still a partner? Do you work from home a lot? And I expected him to be like, here's the magic combination of
right.
words that
this
you
is
need
what
to
you
say.
Can do. Right.
Yeah. And instead he said, no, I actually just bring in a lot of deals. And I thought, well, okay, how do you bring in a deal? Because for me, at the bottom of the food chain, and for a lot of people listening and a lot of people in corporate jobs, they just think, work hard, keep your head down, get stuff done, make your way to the top of the corporate ladder, .. You know a bunch of people, or you join a country club, or you walk in and you get your tenure watch like at Harvard, and then right. they introduce you to everyone. They're like, welcome to the secret Illuminati business right. club. And that wasn't really what seemed to be happening with Dave. What happened with him was he had grown up in Brooklyn. He was always doing jujitsu and golf, and he just was good at being, he was kind of just like a cool guy. Everybody liked hanging out with him, and he was single, I think, for a long time. So he just went out a lot. And then as that worked for him in his career, he just still did it all. And I think eventually in the firm, he was bringing in $1 million legal deal every quarter or something like that or more. They probably went, hey, look, you billing $800 an hour here in the office is not as valuable as you playing racquetball or golf with these dudes from right. Lehman Brothers or Bear Stearns or Goldman. So just go do that. Take the company card, go do that, bring us deals. So he's a rainmaker.
Right.
And he kind of explained this to me. And at this point in the story, everyone's like, did he take you under his wing? No, man. He didn't care at all. He was like, good. Are we done here?
Right. This is what I do.
This is what I do. Go back to work. And I thought, how do I learn this?
Yeah, because, well, it's really hard because I think we all know people like this.
We do, yeah.
That are just like amazing with other people. And I've never been one of those people. Like yeah. I'm a shy guy.
Yeah.
I can turn it on for like camera and stuff like that. But typically I like to like stay in my house, play video games.
Exactly.
Like,
you're not an extrovert.
Right.
And neither am I, even though I've been hosting a show for 11 years. All those personality tests, they show that I'm still introverted. And I used to think that was like a medical excuse for not networking and not developing yeah. relationships. And
I love it as a good excuse not to go to parties and stuff like that. I'll try and stay home.
Of course. Well, I'm going to break your heart here, and your doctor's note is going to fail because there's new research from people like Susan Cain that show that introverts are better at making stronger relationships because we listen when people talk. We are more sensitive to the way that they're behaving, their feelings. We tend to be more observant, whereas extroverts might talk a lot. They look outgoing, or they are outgoing, but they're not necessarily taking enough in. And as you know, if someone's not listening to you, it's like, all right, buddy, I don't want to necessarily be around this person.
Oh, that's interesting because I would say that I have of the friends that I do have, like the dozen or so, like they're really strong, tight yeah. relationships. I don't have a ton of friends. Mm-hmm. I mean, you get to network and meet people, but yeah. I would say my close group, like the people that take a bullet for you, I'm like die hard, like we'll do anything for them, know them really well. So is that a common thing? Do you think that like introverts, they tend to have a smaller group of like really close friends, or am I just odd there?
No, I think that makes perfect sense. And the science shows that those relationships, those friendships are healthier, or at least they're better in the long term. And I won't say healthier, because like the science on whether things make you live longer and friendships and things like that, it's more your department than probably mine. But the idea that introverts can't network because they have a medical excuse or that they're not cut out for it is actually just total BS. It's that we don't want to look fake. We don't want to go out and be like, hey, what's up, everybody? Here's a business card. Next time you need a used car, give me a call, right? That's what we think of when we think of networking.
Exactly.
Whereas extroverted people tend to do it on their own because they don't like networking either, but they go to parties and they talk to everyone. So that works for them. Whereas introverts think, well, if I have to go to a party and talk to everyone like my friend Melanie, then I'm being fake.
Right. See, I feel that like I hate small talk. Mm-hmm. And so I just like I want to cut through the BS and like just get to a real conversation.
I am with you on that. But it can be awkward too, right? Like when I walked in here, you said, hey, what coins are you trading? And I thought, oh, good. I don't have to be like, so what's going on? Oh, is the coffee good? How's that Perrier right. that you bought? Like, I don't care.
We jumped straight into cryptocurrency talk.
Like, show me your blockfolio.
In 10 seconds.
Yeah.
That was awesome, though.
Yeah, it was awesome.
We like spent like 20 minutes. We should have been recording this show. We just talking crypto the entire time.
Exactly. And I'm totally down with that, right? But I think there's certain people that think, well, I can't just do that. I can't just walk up to someone and say, man, I don't like networking events. They're so fake. And I feel like such a tool standing at this thing. But if you walked up to somebody and you were a little uncomfortable and you said that, chances are that person would be like, oh my God, I know. I'm here babysitting these nachos because I don't know what the hell I'm doing here. But I have to come because I'm in the concrete industry and this is a concrete convention.
Right.
So here we are. That's the first connection that you made, right? You had a real conversation. And I think a lot of people don't really know that that's how you can make connections. For example, when I thought that Dave was bringing in deals, my first image was he goes to all these amazing bar association galas and he's like somehow working with these people and dot, dot, dot. They trust him and they give him business. What I didn't realize was he's literally playing racquetball with somebody or squash. Then he goes to some charity dinner that they're having on a cruise ship. And then he probably says something like, so what's coming in the pipe? And they go, oh yeah, we're going to do a big real estate deal. We got a developer on the line. I'll throw it to you on Monday. Cool, man. Yeah. Have you seen the shrimp cocktail? It's amazing. And then it's probably because they're going to throw that business to somebody.
Right.
There's not a whole lot of, tell me what you can do for my firm. Give me a break on the price. They don't care. It's an investment bank. They are printing money. They don't care if it's $20,000 cheaper with somebody else. They like you. They trust you. They know they can reach you on a Sunday if some crap goes down. That's enough for them to give you the deal. $1 million a quarter. And so...
So it's personal trust first, not business trust.
Definitely. I think it starts that way. And I think there's all this rhetoric online. It's like, people need to know, like, and trust you. Totally valid. I definitely believe that. People need to know you. Okay, whatever. Of course, they have to know you. That's a given. Like, and then trust. People, I think, get it backwards. There's a lot of folks that say, well, people need to like you to throw you business. I agree with that. The one caveat is, I think we've all done business with people that we don't really like. Not that we dislike, but we don't like them. But we trust them, and that's more important. And I think that when you can be trusted and liked at the same time, then all other things being equal, they're going to throw it to somebody that they like because they're going to paint a rosier picture of who that person is. So even if Dave was like, I've never done a deal like this before, I don't think the banker would go, oh, well, we really need someone with experience. They'd probably say, that's fine. You'll figure it out. You're a smart guy. Have some more shrimp. And they did that a lot with our firm. Giving us deals, I mean, I don't know how Dave's conversations went specifically, but they gave us a lot of business. And what that meant for Dave's billable hours was something interesting as well. Because if you're a partner at a top market law firm on Wall Street and you're billing out $800 or $1,000 an hour, you could print money if you work 20 hours a day and 7 days a week. You are very valuable to the firm. But if Dave can get a $1 million law deal and he spends 100 hours schmoozing, but then the next $1 million from that same outfit, that same bank and that same banker is 20 additional hours because they already know you.
Right. The upfront work versus the,
Right. So the second 20 hours is worth $1 million, whereas the first 100 was also worth $1 million. You can dollar cost average that out, right? You can average those two things or you can treat them as two separate buys. And that's a really valuable 20 hours. And even if you add those two things together, that 120 hours being worth $2 million, that's a lot of billable hours for an attorney.
So how did you figure out these skills? Like, you saw him, Dave, going off and doing this, and he kind of was like, okay, I'm going to get back to my racquetball. Like, where did you pick up, where did you find the torch to start to carry and like learn those traits?
So what happened after that was I thought, okay, if I can figure out how this works, then that'll be my key to the top of the law game, because this is this competitive advantage that nobody else knew about, right? They were all trying to outwork each other, trying to outsmart each other. And I knew I couldn't do that. It wasn't, I'm too lazy to work. It was, these people are all smarter than me, right? I'm going to get fired, dot, 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 imposter syndrome. I thought, if I focus on learning psychology, learning networking, and developing relationship skills, then in 5 years, when all these junior associates become mid-level and senior associates, they'll go, oh, shoot, I got to learn how to network. I've been in my office for 20 hours a day, 7 days a week. How do I get that process started? And I knew that if they felt like I did at that moment, that they were going to be like, this sounds impossible. I'm not good at this. I'm just going to do what I've always done, which is work extra harder, sit in the office, and do what all these other partners have done. Because that was the example we had. Dave was an anomaly. And the reason I knew about it was because he had hired me, I guess. So he was like assigned to be my mentor. And I never saw him. And everybody else was going to see Blue Man Group and like go out to McCormick and Schmick with their mentor. And I would not do this, by the way. This is not a pro tip. I complained to HR. I was like, my mentor's not around. And they made him take me out for coffee.
No way.
Yeah. So everyone else is going to like.
He must have been pissed.
He was not happy.
Can you imagine HR coming to you and be like, you got to take this dude out for coffee. They'd be like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Imagine you live in a high rise in Brooklyn or something, or wherever he grew up, or Manhattan. And you've got to come into the office, or maybe even Connecticut, right, with your family. You've got to come into the office on a day where you could be doing anything else.
Did he hate you? Like,
No, surprisingly. I think he thought it was enthusiastic that I had questions that I wanted to ask. And I think he realized I've not been around. I'm a crap mentor. I didn't want to mentor you, but I have to, because we each have to mentor two people.
Oh, and that was the rule of
it
the
was
firm?
I think it was like the rule of the firm.
Gotcha.
Each person had like one or two mentees. So he probably got assigned to me by HR, and they were like, just check the box. So everyone's at like fancy steakhouse, Blue Man Group, going to see a Broadway show with their mentor. And the mentors are stoked, right? They're like, this is great. I got a company card. I get to go do whatever
expensive.
I want.
Yeah.
Dave takes me to Starbucks in like the basement of our coffee bean or whatever, in the basement of our office building. And he's hammering on his BlackBerry, and he's like, okay, what do you want to know, man? Just thinking like, so what with mortgage-backed securities and derivatives, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. No, I was like, how come you're a partner, but you're never in the office? I mean, do you work from home? Like, what's going on here?
And he's like, this kid's going to rat me out again.
Yeah, totally. So he put his BlackBerry down and he goes, do people say that I'm not in the office? And at this point, I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to get fired. Everyone's looking at me, which they weren't.
I just want to do what you do.
I was kind of like, how do I tell him that I'm trying not to get fired and I don't belong here, and balance that with the question that I just asked him, which I hadn't thought about his reaction to. And now where do I go with this conversation? Because if he says, yeah, I work from home a lot, what's my follow-up question to that? How do I get that same arrangement?
Right.
You work here for more than 2 months, first of all, right?
Yeah.
I mean, what do I even do? So he actually kind of found that comical, because he thought everybody was talking about how he was never in the office. And that's when he was like, look, I'm doing plenty of stuff, but I'm not billing that many hours. And I said, well, okay, I thought that compensation was primarily based on billable hour bonuses, even for partners. And he goes, oh, okay, well, yeah, that's true, but I don't worry about my billable hour bonus. And I thought, okay, I can live with making less money. Like, keep talking.
Yeah.
Right. And he said, I actually get a commission for each deal that I bring in. So that if he brings in $4 or $5 million in legal deals, that commission outweighs the
bonus. Exactly.
I mean, give me a break. It's probably like four times the bonus, maybe even more. So he just ignores the billable hour bonus completely and focused on the relationships, because the relationships had so much more leverage than everything else. And this was highlighted even more so in 2008, which, to put a timestamp on my legal career, in 2008, everything tanked. The market tanked, the mortgage-backed security, our firm went under.
So this meeting was before
that? It was 2007,
okay.
Yeah. Yeah, and all of the other partners that were at the firm, not maybe not every single person, but a lot of them, they retired even if they were like 45 years old because the firm went into bankruptcy and that's expensive.
Yeah. Air quotes retired.
Air quotes retired.
Yeah.
And Dave walked into another firm as a partner and possibly got a raise. And I thought, how did he do that? And the answer to that question was he had a huge book of business. Some of his clients went out of business, Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers, whatever, but he still had Goldman and all these other clients. So he walked into another place. So this guy who had what everybody thought was the dream life of a partner, jujitsu, golf, cruises, swimming. I know he was into all kinds of stuff, hanging out, cycling. He walked in, job security, no problem. All these other guys that had their head down. I remember walking in there on Tuesday at like 2 a.m. once. Everyone's there working, not Dave. Mm-hmm. Those guys all were punished by the recession. Dave ends up writing his own ticket. And I thought, okay, this is amazing. This is a massive indictment of the keep your head down and work strategy. And it's a huge indicator that making relationships and creating something outside yourself, that network is massively important and is really like the only thing keeping us all from being at the whims of everything else in the economy. So I decided to focus on that. And to answer your question, what I did was I started with some pretty amateur steps, took a Dale Carnegie class. It was okay. But it was more like how to remember people's names and stand up in front of a room and talk. Mm-hmm. All right, no big deal. And then I started reading psychology books and books about networking, reading Dale Carnegie type books that were newer. And I started applying the things that I was learning. And I started even reading books about dating and stuff because I thought, okay, if people don't like me, is it because I don't have a firm handshake and look them in the eye? Because I'm pretty sure that's just like really generic advice that people give when they don't know what else to say. Is it really because I don't smile enough? Maybe. But if people don't like me then, or don't like me enough to call or do business with me, then maybe it's more like dating than it is glad handing. So I started to focus on the dating stuff and that really worked really well.
So let's start with like your adventure into this. So what are some of the things that you started to deploy at this time? So you're starting to read these books, you're picking up little insights.
Yeah.
What are like, as an introvert starting to try and become an extrovert, like what was the first night out on the town? Like what did you start trying to do?
So I started going out. Of course my first gut instinct was call some friends and tell them you want to go out and then trick them into working on these skills. That didn't work because I would call friends. They'd go out.
That's kind of cheating though. They're already your friends.
So totally cheating.
Like,
yeah.
It's not like you're getting any.
But I felt like, oh, if I start talking to strangers while they're there,
it'd be easier on you.
It'll be easier on me because I can always go back to them. I have like an HQ.
Yeah.
And I would talk with them.
If you fail, you can just run back to your friends basically.
Oh, 100%. So I started bringing those people out, but then I was dependent on them being willing to come out, stay out long enough. And then after a while, I realized, oh, if it goes well for me, I'm being rude to my friend because they're sitting there by themselves or with another friend. And if it goes poorly for me, then I'm like drinking with my friend for the fifth night in a row. And it's not really a healthy habit to be in. So I started going out and then people started to say like, hey, I got to study or hey, I can't make it. Or hey, look, actually me and my girlfriend are going to stay in tonight. And then I wouldn't go out and I realized I'm at the whim of all these other people.
Did you go out by yourself?
I went out by myself.
Oh my God. I've never done that.
It was freaking terrible.
I'm just sitting in a bar by myself, but I've never like gone out with the mission of meeting people by myself. That sounds terrifying.
It was terrifying. It was hard. And so what I did was what most people would do in that situation, which is grab a drink, stand in the corner, secretly hope that nobody talked
to
me.
Like dive bar? What are we talking about here?
No, like I went to nicer places because I thought that I went to dive bars too, but I went to nicer places because I thought people might be less clicky if I was in some kind of restaurant situation. And I went to the same place all the time. So I thought worst case, I can talk to the servers, but you know, they're busy on a Friday and Saturday. So that strategy slowly didn't work for me either because it was either successful and I was hiding or I was hiding in the corner or I was talking with my friend, the bartender all night with like small talk. Yeah. And it wasn't any, there was no benefit there. So I realized I had to use my own psychology against me. And this is kind of a little bit of an embarrassing thing, but I knew that I was just going to hide in the corner all the time. So I realized, okay, if I can't hide, then I will be better at this. But how do I not hide? How do I force myself? Because it's easy to go, all right, get out there. Work, you know, be a champion. Rule number 571, play like a champion, right? You're just giving yourself this like wedding crashers pep talk. And I'm trying to put this story together in my mind here. I remember going out and I just couldn't get psyched up enough to be outgoing for longer than a few minutes. And it was exhausting and it felt really fake. Yeah. So I had to find a way to not hide. So I started going to places that had better lighting. That didn't really work. And then I realized that I had to just kind of go balls to the wall. And I got the idea around Halloween because I went out in a costume on Halloween.
By yourself?
By myself. Okay. And I was a kangaroo, but I didn't put the head thing on.
Yeah, because that would make it creepy or something.
It was creepy and it was also hiding. And so a lot of people talked to me and I had a baby stuffed kangaroo in like the stomach pouch.
Yeah.
And it's a costume I bought in Japan. I got it in Japan at a department store, like an all-night department store.
Yeah.
I knew that you were going to ask me where you got that costume. Yeah. So I brought it home. I wore it. And then I wore it again the next day. And then a lot of people were talking to me and like, oh, I guess it's still Halloween. And then 10 days later, I was still wearing this costume.
Wait, not consecutive days.
Probably more or less consecutive days. I went out in a kangaroo suit.
You just kept going out in a kangaroo suit?
I kept going out because it was causing a lot of people to come and talk to me. And I just kept wearing it.
Oh my God.
Over, and I was washing it and I keep wearing it. And months later, I'm like still the guy in the kangaroo suit. And I realized I was just kind of like this circus act guy that would go out in a kangaroo suit.
Oh my God.
And then it was like this dumb crutch.
I mean, you're not getting... Your goal here was not to pick up on women at this point.
No. Okay. I was just like chatting and I was talking with a lot of women in this kangaroo suit and I thought this is a cool trick, but here's the problem.
It's a little bit of a crutch though, right?
It's a ridiculous, dumb crutch. Think about this. If you can't meet people or you can't get a date without your kangaroo suit, like what's wrong with you?
Right.
There's something wrong with you. So I decided that since so many people had been talking to me wearing the kangaroo suit, and I transitioned those people in normal conversations because it wasn't just like, hey, high five, kangaroo, and then move on to the next person.
Yeah.
I would sit with people and have in-depth conversations. And I met people and I saw them there again. And people were inviting me to
like,
parties.
Why are you wearing this, right?
After a while, they're like, dude, why are you wearing the kangaroo suit? And I would tell them, I'm shy and this makes it impossible for me to not get attention. And they're like, oh. And I remember this older couple that was really well connected. They were like the chief fundraiser charity people for the hospital, University of Michigan Hospital. They invited me to these charity events and they're like, oh, it's the guy in the kangaroo suit. And the woman eventually goes, look, honey, you can't keep wearing the kangaroo suit. I know it's working for you, and I know that you're shy, but you're just as shy or not shy without it. So.
How long have you been doing this for?
It was like 10 or 12 days, 15 days.
Okay, so you weren't doing this for like 6 months to a year.
No, that would be even more pathetic, than it was already.
Okay.
Yeah. No, it was probably 2 to 3 weeks.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's.
And she was like, you don't need to keep doing this. Because they thought, oh, one-off stunt to get out, shake off some nerves. So I started going out dressed normally. And I just went to the same people. I now knew all the regulars and all these people who frequented these restaurants and bars. And I just kept talking with them. And then I felt really at home starting conversations with other people. And I realized that since that kangaroo suit had made it impossible for me to be shy, I realized I wasn't actually that shy. I was just afraid of rejection. But since that rejection was pretty minor when it came, which was much more rare than I thought, it just wasn't a big deal for me. And I realized I could do everything that I wanted to do without this dumb, dirty as hell at this point, kangaroo suit. And so I stopped wearing it and I realized I didn't need it at all. And it was a really important realization because it made me think for a while that and to this day made me realize that it doesn't really matter. This thing that you use to start the conversation, obviously it's going to be something stupid. It's a freaking right. kangaroo suit. But people weren't like, oh, you can sit at our table because you're wearing a kangaroo suit. They were just like, you can sit at our table and talk with us because you just sat down without being invited and you were not a weirdo.
Yeah.
I was more weird with a kangaroo suit on than I was without one.
But how did that shift in terms of like, obviously the kangaroo suit is like a great jumping off point to talk about something.
Yeah.
And you being someone that doesn't like small talk like me, like, hey, how's your day? Weather's crazy. You know, like what did you go to? What was your go-to? Like, I want to approach someone. I want to sit down. I want to have a conversation. What do you say? I mean, do you believe in like quote unquote like openers? We're using a lot of air quotes.
Yeah. This episode. I did at the time, but I realized those didn't make a difference either. And what you meant by openers, I assume, is some of these old like pickup artist things where it's like, hey, did you see the fight outside? These two girls were totally
going at it. Yeah, just something to say to kind of like kick off a conversation.
Yeah.
Like, how do you deal with that?
I used to lean on that for a long time. And then I kind of realized, well, wait a minute. The kangaroo suit was a crutch. These openers are a crutch and it really doesn't matter. So I started experimenting with ridiculous things. So of course I started with that canned stuff that I would keep written in my pocket on a note card. And I recently donated some clothes I had from college and I looked in the pocket and there was a post-it note with like mechanical pencil writing on it that was like opener list. And it was the dumbest things I can't believe I used to use. Things like, oh, did you see the fight outside? Or like all this canned stuff
was
that I got
off
the
internet. Was there even
a fight outside? No, I would get it off like the internet or like, hey, did you see that guy?
Just lying to people.
It was so stupid, but I was insecure, right?
Super
insecure.
Yeah,
I had to rely on something. So I started to do this. I changed up my strategy, which was I would go sit down with a group of people and say something just that was at the top of my mind. Not the first thing that popped in, because sometimes, you know, you don't want to be like, I like turtles.
Yeah.
You could, but it's talk about handicapping yourself. So I would sit down and go, hey guys, I think I've seen you guys here before. If that were indeed true, and I came up with the idea that I would never lie. And I'd say, you look really familiar, but now I can't decide if you just look like somebody I know or not. And then I would introduce myself to the group. And a lot of times they were just like, oh yeah, we're just hanging out. You know, you can stay here. Cause I'd say, oh wait, am I interrupting a private conversation? And they go, no, that's fine. And I would just chill with them for like an hour and know everyone. And then I would see them again somewhere, or they would call me, or they'd say, hey, it's Angela's birthday party on Saturday. Do you want to come by and you can bring your friend? Because I was sometimes bringing my friends around.
Yeah.
And they were actually I was sometimes bringing around strangers, because at this point, months later, a lot of people that had gone out with their friends or alone, either to meet women or just because they were bored foreign exchange students or something, they would see me running around and they'd go, hey, if I buy you a drink, can you show me how you're starting conversations? And I was like, yeah, I totally know what you're after. I was just like you like 60 days ago.
Yeah.
I would love to share this with people because it's working.
That's awesome.
So I helped start all these. I remember these two guys were like from Syria and they were like, we just have no idea how to make friends in America. It's so hard. And I said, let's just go hang out and walk around and go to like fairs and we'll go to the mall and I'll just show you how easy it is to talk to people. And they looked at me like I was a superhero. And that really helped me as well, because now I had, if you're alone and you don't feel like doing it, you can just give up and be like, today I don't feel like it because it's raining.
Right.
You can make up some rationalization.
Excuse to go home, yeah.
But if there's two guys that are like, you're the coolest guy in America, you don't want to disappoint them.
Right.
And so I started to just act as if, because I was like, I can't let these two guys down. They drove all the way out here. We're at the mall right now. I have to do what they expect, which was also unhealthy pressure to put on myself, but at the time was a really good kick in the pants to show off. And so, yeah, at first it was focused on like, these guys were enthralled with American women. But after a while, they're like, man, you know, wherever we go, people seem to like you. And it was true. And I didn't even notice it then, because I was so used to being a shy, quiet kind of nerd. Not kind of, nerd.
Yeah.
Just very nerd. And after a while, the reputation started to go around about me and my friend that who I went out with all the time, who was also interested in this stuff, because it would be like St. Paddy's Day. And line around the block for the Irish pub. And somebody would walk out. You know how they check IDs preliminarily?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you get out of line, you're too young. They would come up and they go, hey, Jordan, what's going on, man? You don't have to wait in this line. He goes, go to the back door. Connor's back there. And I go, oh, okay. Walk around to the back door. And Connor would go, Jordan, get up here, man. And we would cut in front of literally 100 people. He'd go, your money's no good here. We'd walk in. They'd go, the owner's table is up by the blackboard with the specials. We'd walk over there and the owner would go, oh, hey guys, what's up? Sit down, have a beer. And he would pour us a beer. We're sitting at a table in an Irish pub where you can't move.
Yeah.
At all. And then he's like, oh, my friends don't pay for drinks in my pub. So we would just hang out. And this is like the biggest night of the year for them.
Yeah.
And we're hanging out with like him and his family from Ireland. And I just thought, I feel like royalty in this town. And other places, like other restaurants would say things like, hey, do your parents own a lot of property in Ann Arbor? And I'd say, no, why? Well, you don't pay for anything and everybody knows who you are. I just figured maybe you're one of the landlords.
So this is like a compounding effect of understanding how to read people and network properly is like you get all these extra additional perks and benefits from it.
Yeah. I remember sitting down at a restaurant that was closed with a date, and we tried to order some food. It had turned into a bar. The kitchen was closed. And it turned into a bar, and the server came over, and I was like, oh, hey, we want this and this. And she goes, oh, I'm sorry, the kitchen's closed. And I said, oh, shoot, because it was my fault. We were late. We were dilly-dallying, and then she was hungry. And I thought, like, oh, crap. And she goes, hold on a second, Jordan. She comes back, and she goes, all right, the kitchen is closed, but look what I got for you. And she unveils this, like, amazing dessert spread, and everybody in the whole bar is like, oh, can we get that too? And she's like, sorry, he's the owner's friend. Yeah. And everyone's like, what? And I'm like, hey, there's plenty of cookies. There were like 50, and it was probably from some event they'd catered, and they were just left over.
Yeah.
So all the staff is coming over and popping. They're like, these are amazing. And half of the bar, I'm like, have a cookie, man, have a cookie. And someone's like, you've given me and my table like 5 cookies. What are you drinking? So we stopped paying for drinks. And like, you're right. The compounding effect was such that we never paid for drinks. We never paid for food. We never had to wait in line. And that worked really well for the original intent, which was making friends and looking cool at the time when we were geeks. Because now we look the part. We would walk around and people would yell at us on the street, like, hey, Jordan, come by later. I'm working tonight.
So it's putting in a lot of upfront effort to kind of eventually get to the point where all this starts to kind of fall in place.
Exactly.
How do you – one of the things that I'm trying to figure out is, you know, we've all had that person sit down at our table at a bar, you know, unexpectedly, someone that comes up trying to introduce themselves. Mm-hmm. And – it can go like one of two ways, right? You're either like, oh, this guy seems pretty cool. Like, sure, let's have a conversation. Or you can be like, oh, this person seems a little bit creepy.
Yeah.
We're kind of busy. We're like doing our own thing. Can you kind of like go off and see you later?
Yeah.
That's a fine line, right? Like, how do you avoid being creepy?
Sure. So that's a really good question. And I think it's a problem that a lot of people have, especially guys when they're trying to do this stuff initially.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because like my story is right now, I want to really emphasize the fact that I'm not trying to be like, look how cool I was in law school. I was totally quiet, shy, and awkward. The reason this started working so quickly, or the reason I'm telling this, is because it started working so quickly. And the reason it started working so quickly was because my agenda went from, I'm going to meet tons of girls, to I just need to learn how to make friends because this has been hard for me like pretty much my whole life. And so I thought it was great. And I thought those relationships were really interesting because they stopped being shallow and they got deeper. And I can go into that in a second.
But that's a really important point though, because you can tell when someone is on a mission for something, mm-hmm. like I've had people approach me, because they want something out of me financially. They're like, oh, he needs to invest in my startup or he needs to like, you know, and you can tell pretty quickly that their intention is to really just suck something out of you. And then I've had other people that just take the time to get to know you, comment on something that you have a mutual interest in. It's a lot more legitimate. We build up a friendship and then eventually we have a business relationship as well.
Yeah.
And those things, that actually works.
Yes.
So your point is like, I'm not the guy going out to meet girls. I'm the guy just going out to make friends.
Yeah.
And that will in turn lean to one, good friendships with other people, guys and girls, and two, would, you know, you're going to meet more girls that way as well, as like a side effect.
Exactly. And that shift was hugely important because I was hitting my head against the wall trying to go out and meet women. Sure, it worked sometimes because you just meet somebody and they're like, hey, I came here with my friend from out of town and we're here to like hook up or whatever.
Yeah.
But that wasn't really what I wanted either, because I've always been kind of a relationship guy, and I thought if I meet some random gal who's from like another part of the state, this is not real. Even if I'm successful, I still lose. So that wasn't going to work for me. After a few weeks of that, I just thought, this is stupid. So I dropped the agenda of trying to pick up women, and I started to really work on the agenda of trying to make real relationships. And there was one couple in particular that really showed me this. Going back to the kangaroo suit days, this couple that I met, they were older, and they spent every Friday night having dinner at this restaurant where I also went out. And they would go, you're so funny. We see you here talking with people all the time. You know, you're just such a naturally good connector. And I told them everything. I was like, I'm not. I'm in law school. I'm terrible at it. I'm horribly shy. She was the one who's like, honey, please take off the kangaroo suit.
Right.
But she was really well connected. And she was a really good connector with charities. She was a really good connector with the university. So I was at these dinners with them where it's like the regents of the university would show up. They'd go, hey, come sailing with us this weekend. And I was like, what do you, You have a boat? What universe am I in where I know somebody has a sailboat and owns real estate complexes? It was just they were so many rungs above me on the socioeconomic ladder, but they liked me and they saw some potential that I didn't see. And if I'd just been out to meet women, I would have ignored this older couple in 5 seconds. But right. I just really liked them and they saw something in me and they liked me. And that changed my mind about this process. Because I thought, all right, I can get good at meeting women who are out to hook up with dudes, or I can do something that really does build my career and really does get me to the top of the law game and really does build relationships with people that are smarter than me, that have life experience. That seems much more valuable than hooking up like once a week. So I had to ditch the agenda of meeting women. And I just said, I'm here to just talk with everyone. And I met plenty of women. I met plenty of chefs. I met plenty of bartenders. And I also met plenty of every other person. I would run into my law professors there. That would help me out later. I ran into other attorneys there. I got job offers doing this stuff.
I think that's part of the way to avoid being creepy too, is to not have that agenda.
Exactly. Yeah. To your point, having an agenda where what you're doing, saying, or your appearance, if it mismatches your agenda, that is the definition of creepy. So when guys come up and they're like, oh, hey, where'd you get that handbag? It's creepy because they're devouring you, and ladies who are listening to this will know, they're devouring you with their eyes. They don't care where you got that handbag. They're just coming up with a pretext to talk to you. Now you have to guess what their agenda is.
Right.
And when women have to guess what your agenda is, there's one or two guesses and they're going to be hitting the nail on the head. And they have safety concerns with this. But if I come in and I'm just like, I'm going to talk to the guys as much as I talk to the women. I'm going to talk to the 58-year-old woman as much as I talk to her 21-year-old daughter. And that was so effective in every single way that I remember after a while thinking, wait a minute, even if I have no agenda to meet and attract women, I'm doing that much more than I was before. And I'll never forget going around with these Syrian guys. They were like, wow, look at this beautiful girl. And there was this like 22-year-old blonde gal, super cute, with her mom at a Starbucks. And they're like, how do you separate from mom? And I was like, you don't. You don't do that. That's weird. Don't even think about that. So I walked up and I sat with both of them and I said, hey, I'm so sorry to bug you, but you guys look so cute. And my friends over there are not going to let me leave unless I came over here and started a conversation, because they're from another country and they can't believe that you can just walk up and talk to women here. And the mom goes, well, isn't that adorable? And she goes, you should meet more guys like this. And she waved my friends over and they sat down and they were just like, unable to speak. They were so shocked. And I was myself pretty impressed that this worked out, because that mom could have been like, well, that's weird. Get the hell away from me. Yeah. I have pepper spray in my purse. But we had so many interactions like that. And the mom was like, where do you go to school? Where do you hang out? Shelly, you should keep in touch with Jordan. And the girl was like, okay, like kind of laughing and embarrassed. And I ended up going out with her a bunch of times and becoming friends with her as well and meeting a bunch of her friends. And it was all because it was like, look, I'm just here to not worry about the outcome of these situations. And that served me well in business as well.
When you say not worry about the outcome, you must, like, we all have to deal with rejection around, especially when you get into this and you want to like put yourself out there. How do you deal with that? Or how did you in those early days, like, how do you frame that in your mind so it's not just devastating?
Right. It was devastating in the beginning because you build it up so much. And what I had to do after a while was get plenty of rejection and find that it just didn't really matter because it was very rarely based on me.
So you didn't seek it out though. You weren't like, you just.
In many ways, you're always asking for it if you go talk to strangers.
Yeah.
But a lot of the rejection that I got was so minor. It was like, hey, actually, man, no offense, you seem cool, but we're having a personal conversation. I'd go, oh yeah, no problem. I'm so sorry. And then a lot of times later they'd go up and say, hey, thanks for being cool about that. Her mom is going through some shit and I'm like, oh, I totally understand. Other times girls would go, why are you talking to us? And I would just be like, oh, well, if that was the only interaction of the night, it's easy to go, oh my God, you know, I'm so weird. Why did I do that? I'm going to break down this reaction for the rest of the week and think about it and let it get into my psyche and become weirder by having this replay in my head. But if I talk to 20 groups of people in one night, everybody's really friendly. And then one group of people says, why are you talking to us? Get out of here. They're the weirdos, not the other 20 people who are really nice that I've seen before. And the more repetition you have, I remember one instance in particular that really framed what you're talking about here. I said hello to this group of girls. They were really rude. Me and my friends were, we walked away from them. My other friend was really, it was like one of his first nights out. He was really upset by this. It really rattled him. So I said, screw it.
How are they really rude?
Like, what? They were like, get the fuck out of here. You guys are ugly. Like the worst rejection you could get. Yeah. The worst you could imagine. Very rare. Okay. Very, very rare. And then I mean, who says that? It's like so rude out of nowhere. It's just shocking. Yeah. Okay. And I was talking to him, and another group of people that we knew showed up, and I was like, oh, hey, look, let's talk to some friendly people. So I waved him over. They came and sat with us. These are people I probably met a week ago. And I said, you're never going to guess what happened. We went to go talk to this group of girls, and they were like, get out of here. You guys are ugly. And the guys and the girls, they just started laughing. And I was like, it is funny. And my friend was like laughing a little. He's like, look, we're laughing because it's so ridiculous. And then they go, which girls? And I said, oh, those girls over there. And she goes, I kicked those girls out of my restaurant a few weeks ago. They're underage.
Oh,
and I said,
wow.
Oh, that explains a lot. They're young. They don't know how to act. They're insecure. So she goes, well, that's not going to stand at all. And she goes, hey, James, to the doorman. She goes, those girls are underage. And he goes, oh, really? How do you know? She goes, I kicked them out of my restaurant last week. He walked up there and he goes, girls, can I see your ID? And they were like, no. And he's like, well, I work here and you're going to have to leave. And they were like, I got an ID, and they pulled out this like POS fake ID, and he goes, you guys are going to have to leave. And they started causing a huge scene, and they were like swatting at this giant doorman, and he took them out and threw them out the door, not violently, but he pushed them kind of by force out the door. And I looked at my friend who was feeling so horrible about this awful rejection. And I go, so do you think that you're the bad guy in this situation? Yeah. Or are they, and is this a weird anomaly? And he's like, oh, okay. That makes more sense.
That's a great point. Cause if your intent is really just to go out, be a good person, meet new people. If someone is being negative to you,
yeah,
that's their own issue that they're having to deal with. Something's not going right with their day,
yeah,
or how they feel. You have the best intention. So you can just be okay with that, actually.
Yeah. I mean, look, if somebody came up to you and I and we were having a drink and they're like, hey, guys, what's going on? We might be like, oh, hey, all right. And then if he's like, hey, do you mind if I sit down? We might say, sure, we're just waiting for our wives. Or we might say, actually, we're talking about a business thing. It's nothing personal. We probably would not say, oh, gross.
You're so ugly.
What a freak. Get yeah. out of here, you asshole. Like, we would not do that ever. So the type of person that would really doesn't reflect on you as a person.
Right. And it's not someone you want to even be friends with to begin with. So.
Right. But if this is your only reaction, if this is the only reaction you've had and you've just decided to come out of your shell, it can be jarring.
Yeah.
So really you do need repetition about this.
Right.
Luckily, the older we are, the less likely we are to deal with extreme amounts of BS like that.
Mm-hmm.
If you go out when you're 21, you're going to meet some men and women who are dicks, period. Mm-hmm. If you go out when you're 31, the odds of you running into somebody who's like, get out of here, you freak. I haven't used that kind of language in a decade and a half. And even then, I was probably well past the maturity level where I should be talking like that, right? So if you're looking at this and you're thinking like, I can't do that, or I don't need to do that because I'm in a relationship, then that was another big lesson for me actually was, once you start to get into this and you've got plenty of friends and you're dating and stuff like that, a lot of people stop learning this because they think, oh, good thing I'm married and I don't need this. And what we teach on the Art of Charm podcast especially is that this should permeate your life no matter what. And a lot of the listeners to the show are men and women who are in their 30s, 40s, 50s. And they go, I just wish I'd known this 10 years ago, because all of the things that we're talking about that I did in law school and college, at the bars and clubs and things like that, all of this meshes perfectly well with the corporate environment, making connections. You don't necessarily do it at bars. You don't even do it at networking events necessarily, but you start to learn about how elite super connectors talk and interact with each other. So that couple that I met that was into real estate and charity, I'll never forget the way they introduced me in front of people in person and in email. Do you know what the double opt-in introduction is? Have you heard about this before?
I can imagine what it is, but I don't think so.
So we'll teach it right now, because why not get away with a practical here? I'll never forget. I learned this because I wanted to go to this charity event that they were throwing, and they wanted me to come for free, and it was probably like $3,000 a plate at some fancy place. And it was for the University of Michigan Medical School. She goes, bring your friend, the woman who's organizing it, bring your friend who wants to apply to medical school, because he was in the biology department. All the chief residents and the admissions committee, all that stuff, the chief of surgery, the regents, all those guys are going to be there. These are really good people to know if you're applying to medical school. So I said, okay, fine, let's do that. We went, we ate dinner, we small talked, we hung out with these doctors, we had a drink, had a laugh, and she goes, great. And I said, I don't really understand how that helps, but thank you so much. And she goes, oh, we're not done yet. This is the beginning of the process, not the end. A day later, she sends an email to, she BCC'd me, she CC'd my friend, and she CC'd the doctor who happened to be on the admissions committee. And she said, hey, I forget his name, Jim, whatever. You met these two young gentlemen yesterday at our charity event. So-and-so is applying to medical school. I know you're not supposed to do anything unexpected. I can't remember exactly how she phrased it, but it was this really interesting introduction where she had asked for his permission beforehand to introduce him to my friend. And she had, of course, asked us if it was okay. And she had said something like, I know you don't have the ability to let it just anybody into Michigan, but this guy's really smart and he wants to know what best practices are. And this guy replied, well, I can't show you any favoritism. However, I can tell you, and he gave all this useful information. And he goes, and I can tell you that if you have any other questions, you can call my office and just say that we met through this woman. And I thought, wait a second. This is incredible. So the double opt-in intro is super effective because it gets emotional and tactical buy-in from everybody. So what it does is if I want to introduce you to somebody else, I say, hey, Kevin, do you know my friend Jamie? And you say, no, I don't think so. Well, Jamie works in cryptocurrency. He's always down to meet investors who are also into cryptocurrency. Would you take that introduction? You say, yeah, sure. Then I go to him and I do the exact same thing. So I get buy-in from both of you.
Gotcha.
And that's important before I make that introduction, because if I just say, hey, Kevin, what's up, dude? Good hanging yesterday. My friend Jamie's also in crypto. You're like, oh, crap. I got to reply to this guy. I'm busy. I have no context. What is this all about?
Right.
And other negative outcomes can come by as well. You can say, oh, shoot, Jamie, I've been avoiding this guy for like 3 months. He's emailed me 100 times. Now I'm stuck in my inbox with our mutual friend. I look like a jerk if I don't answer.
Right.
Now you're in a weird place. You don't like me necessarily for that. You're not super stoked that I did that. Or you're thinking, I can't talk to investors or inventors of new coins. I've got all this other crap on my plate.
Right.
This is the last kind of person I want to meet. I'm ignoring hundreds of these people in my inbox right now. Or you might say, yeah, I already know him. We've been friends for like 2 years. And then I look dumb again. So there's all these negative outcomes that can happen through an unsolicited introduction. And it takes me 2 seconds to take 2 extra emails, make sure you're both interested in the introduction, and then introduce you to each other.
Right.
You should never do any other kind of introduction.
Yeah. The only other one that I do is, let's say somebody wants to reach out to someone who I'd consider a pretty private person, or someone that has a big following. Let's say someone want to reach out to you, right?
Yeah.
Rather than just introduce you blindly, I would say, well, I'll forward your email and along with your contact details, mm-hmm. and then he can respond back if he wants to get back to you.
I do that all the time with influencers.
Yeah.
So that's what I would do with you. Hey, I forwarded. In fact, I think I did do this with you. Somebody said, hey, something about heart rate on the Kevin Rose said on The Art of Charm. Does your heart rate blah, blah, blah. And I said, well, all right, I'm not going to let
you. Yeah, I didn't respond to that guy.
You didn't respond to that guy. Okay.
Well, it didn't make, you answered it for the question for me.
Oh, was I right?
Yeah, you were right. Yeah.
I wasn't sure about that. So I said, if it makes sense for Kevin to respond, he will. And they were like, oh, great. So all I did was forward that and then reply to that email.
Right.
With one.
That's another good tactic. Yeah.
It is. However, if someone is asking, if I think it's a mutually beneficial introduction,
right, exactly.
It doesn't really make sense to be like, hey, Kevin, email me something random and I'll send it to this other random person you don't know. So you should always do the double opt-in intro.
Yeah.
Always, 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 pretty much without exception. We should think of a term for like, it's like the no look pass intro, right? Where you sort of BCC someone on it. In fact, I don't even think I forwarded it to you. I think I BCC'd you on my reply.
On your reply, that's right.
So that you could see the whole thread. Yeah, that's like the no-look pass, I think. That's what we can call that.
That's funny.
It's important to do the double option because it shows that you respect both people's time. And I know what people are thinking right now. What if one person says no? It's okay because that's the whole point of the double opt-in. Sometimes people are going to say no. It's better they say no during one of the parts of the opt-in than during the intro already.
Right.
Like if you have to reply, hey, Jamie, long time no see, still can't help you with BS coin because I'm just slammed for time. I really apologize. Cool that you know Jordan. Bye. And then you're like, please don't email me again.
Yeah.
Right.
What do you do if you want to meet someone that you are like, okay, I need to, like, let's say I'll just pick someone like Elon Musk. Okay. Mm-hmm. You want to go and get an introduction to this guy. You want to meet him. You think you could be friends or have some kind of relationship.
Elon, we have so much in common.
You're so tight with Elon. No, but what would you do if someone is out of your kind of like, not to say that Elon's out of your range in terms of like, you know.
He's out of a lot of ranges.
Yeah, he's out of a lot of ranges. But like someone that is a few steps up on the ladder from you and you kind of want to network and expand and get to know this person because you've heard them on a podcast. Like, what do you do in that situation?
So there's a couple of routes to do this. If it's somebody like Elon Musk, looking for mutual connections is the best way to do this. That's really tricky for someone listening right now is like, mutual connections to Elon Musk? Sure, let me just email Steve Jobs. I mean, I don't even know. Somebody preferably alive.
Yeah.
but email address probably still works. I'm going to throw that out there. But you have to email somebody who's like 10 rungs away from them.
So it's like a LinkedIn
It's like
game
a LinkedIn thing.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. You have to think about, there's a whole lot of things you can ask about this, but I would say you have to think about why you want that introduction. Do you just want to go hang out with Elon
right.
Musk? Why? You're going to take selfies?
That's the creepy side of things.
That's the creepy side of things. Yeah, you're right. The other side of this is actually I know something that is going to be super interesting to him. Well, great. His office is designed to get him good ideas and filter out ones that are not good. So try different avenues. Send your idea to his office. This is a guy who answers his own Twitter. There's tons of people in our circles that have access to him. Tim Urban is somebody that wrote about him that gets calls from him. He probably wouldn't say, sure, let me introduce you to Elon. But he might say, actually, I go through his office. Here's the general number. You can ask for his assistant. This is her name. She's probably going to screen you out, but this is the best I can do.
Sure.
That's better than nothing. And if you have a real compelling reason to connect with somebody like that, you can make it happen. So for me, also looking at opportunities to help that person is paramount. Do you have something that's interesting that they don't know about yet? Reach out to them with it as soon as humanly possible. Is there something that you think they would find uniquely entertaining? My license plate is Elon fan. It was my wife's idea. So I sent him a picture of that.
Wait, and you're joking.
No, I'm not joking.
I had no idea when I said the Elon Musk thing that you...
Yeah. My wife's.
Are you kidding?
My wife got Elon fan as our Tesla's license plate.
Oh, that's so funny.
So people take pictures of it all the time and tag him in it all the time. And we're like,
that's
okay.
A little creepy though. It's on the creepier side.
Hey, look, it was my wife. You can blame her. I had nothing to do with it. I had nothing to do with that one. So it's a little too convenient, right? Most people aren't going to. Sorry, if you're in California, you can't have Elon fan because I have it. My wife has it anyway. She was shocked when it was available. I was less surprised. So I thought, no, of course it's going to be available. It's definitely going to be available. So I sent a picture of that to him on Twitter. He did not reply. No big deal. Jen's like, we should make a big one and mail it to him. I was like, no, that's weird. But you can if you want to. But for people at that level, that really elite level, they're looking for things that are funny, entertaining, or about their business or a mutual connection. And the way that I'm able to get celebrities on the show, like Russell Brand and Larry King and people like that, is I've worked really hard on getting into those circles and getting the respect of the people in those circles by
in their circles, not in, them directly.
In their circles. Yeah. And then it's
that double opt-in introduction. It comes down to that eventually.
It is. Yeah. So one of the ways that I get connected to someone like Russell Brand is working really hard on building a platform like the Art of Charm podcast, building up the numbers so that other authors and other people in his exterior circle find that this platform has a good reputation, sending them things and helping them out with things like articles, introductions, publicity for something that they're working on, connections to press and other podcasters, for example, which is something that I'm able to connect these people to.
So, I mean, this is very key, though. You said helping them out.
Yeah, I was helping them out.
You do the heavy lifting first up front.
Always.
So that's an important piece of this is like proving your worth before there's an ask.
All the time, yeah. And a lot of people are going, oh, I just need a podcast that has 4 million downloads and then I can reach out to these people. It's not helpful. the platform doesn't have to be a show with 4 million people. The platform can be the dinner party that you have at your house where you invite all of your cryptocurrency buddies over to talk about different coins. And then you invite one guy who's particularly knowledgeable and he gives a short presentation about what to look for in blockchain technology. Everyone's interested. You're the host of that platform. The next week or the next month, you have another dinner party and you find another guest teacher or you do it yourself. Now suddenly you're the guy who runs the crypto dinners.
Right.
That's a really good place to be because now you can reach out to any of those people and you can reach out to people you don't know and say, hey, it's Kevin from Crypto Dinners. We have dinners every week at places where we talk about blockchain technology. It's not hard to find people interested in that these days, but you might be able to get somebody like the creator of Ethereum who's in town to come to your crypto dinner.
Right.
And then you start getting more of these types of folks coming
building on that. Yeah.
You build that cachet. And eventually I had pitched Russell Brand to come on The Art of Charm 100 times and I never got any response. And I got warm introductions and his people had said no. Then he came out with a book and his people reached out and said, hey, I know we met you through so-and-so. I was wondering if you're still interested in having him on the show. He has a book, so now he's doing press. We normally don't do press, but he's going to do a few podcasts. And he came on The Art of Charm and I think Joe Rogan and one or two others, and he was done. And Bill Maher and all
That's
those
awesome.
Shows. And after the show, he goes, this is pretty good. And I said, well, how do I get better at this? And who else do you think would do the show? And he goes, I don't know off the top of my head, but email me. And I said, okay, expect him to like have his assistant give me some dead end email. And he goes, my email address is this. Don't share it because I don't read my email that much and I don't want to get more. But he's just email me tonight and I'll look next week and I'll think of something. So I got his personal email address. So now if I need to run into somebody else in his circle, I'll just ask him because he basically invited me to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. 11 years of doing this show, you must have picked up like a ton of good tips throughout. How many episodes total have you done?
Like 900 and some.
That's insane.
There are number of people will look and they'll go, there's only 700 and some here. But we label Minisode Mondays differently, Fan Mail Friday differently. Bonus episodes aren't numbered. So altogether, there's like 900 plus episodes.
I don't even know how you would distill that down, but like, what are the things like, if we're getting back to some more like tangible takeaways that people can have, what are like the five things that have stuck with you over those 900 episodes that you're like, oh my God, I'm so glad I know this now.
Sure. The double opt-in is one good one.
Yeah.
This one's really obvious and cliche, but I'm going to say it anyway. You have to figure out what's in it for other people. And I know that that sounds so obvious, but I will tell you, for every one person that says, I have an idea, let me know if you're interested in this, I get 100. Hey, what's your address? I want to send you a copy of my book. You're not doing me a favor by doing that. So you have to think about what's in it for them. And I think a lot of people don't think far enough into this. If I say something like, let me send you a copy of my book, I'm not really being generous by giving you a copy of my book that you could buy for $8 if you were even remotely interested in that, or 14 or whatever books cost. I'm just saying, I want to get on your radar, take a bunch of time to absorb my work. That's BS. So people will say things like, oh, look at what's in it for them. Oh, well, they can have me as a great guest on their show. That's not what I'm talking about. What I'm talking about is, look, I know I'm not in a position to help Kevin Rose make more money by investing in Jordan Coin. So I'm not going to ask you for that. What I might do is say, hey, actually, I have this random connection to the creator of Ethereum. I know you're interested in blockchain. Let me know if that's ever of use to you. And then you might be thinking, holy crap, you know the creator of Ethereum? That's kind of neat. Sure, actually, I do have some investors for this other project that were interested in bringing him on as a consultant. I'm not a part of that transaction other than I'm connecting you to other people in my network. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying, hire me for this, or I'll do work for you for free, which is unscalable. If I'm a web designer, I can't make 100 free websites. Mm-hmm. But I might be able to introduce you to a good graphics person, you to a good web design person. And all I do is send emails. So you got to look at what's in it for them without that veneer of like, secretly, though, I get this benefit.
Right.
Get rid of that. And it has to be scalable. That's, I guess, point number three. So like I said, I can't make 50 free websites, but I can introduce you to other people in my network that can help make that happen. That's scalable for me. I could send 100 emails a day before lunch. And those connections will bear fruit for years.
Right.
Because if I introduce two people and they end up working together, or even if they're just like, thanks, this didn't work out, I build social capital on my end doing that. So it has to be scalable. Yeah. So make it scalable, make it what's in it for them, and the double opt-in intro. So that's three. I'd say the fourth thing that people should know is that it's always better to tell someone what you do in layman's terms so that they can tell other people. And we have whole techniques for this that we teach at The Art of Charm, but I'll give you the short version. If you ask people in Silicon Valley what they do, they often say things like, oh, I do custom data management solutions for cloud computing.
Right.
That sounds like something I might be able to figure out. But if you tell my wife that, and she tells her brother that, and he tells the cousin that for some reason, do you think that the person on the end of that game of telephone is going to understand what the hell you do?
Well, it sounds so boring to begin with. You're not even going to probably won't even make that many jumps because no one even wants to talk about something they don't understand how to relate.
Exactly. Exactly. So if let's choose an even better example that's less Silicon Valley, because there's people at home that go, everybody knows what I do. There's plenty of people when I worked on Wall Street that said, I do risk management for international entities on the reinsurance side or something like that. Well, that's terrible. That's a terrible description of your job. If you're looking to meet people who are Fortune 500 executives that might be able to purchase your solution, what you should say is, I insure US companies in case their sister companies overseas do something illegal. I'm looking to meet Fortune 500 executives in the legal department. And people go, oh, my cousin's a lawyer for Microsoft, or at least he used to be. Would that be helpful? Yeah, maybe. Cool. Let me text him. Okay, he doesn't work at Microsoft. He works at Google. I knew he jumped ship, but he's still in compliance. Is that what you're looking for? Absolutely. Can you connect me with him? Maybe he's not the guy in charge of purchasing. His boss's boss is, but you already have a foot in the door now. Now you know someone there. Okay, but if you say that whole complicated data management or the risk compliance, I'm not able to use my brain who's not in that industry. I can't use my brain to figure out how to connect you to those people.
Right. Well, and it stops the conversation too, right?
Because
if you can't understand something that someone does.
Right.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So I have to be able to say something about what I do in a way, or what you do in a way, that can make a game of telephone all the way down the line, so that if somebody is looking to help you or you're needed by somebody, then fine. If I say, I currently work with litigation professionals such that we create data management solutions for litigation professionals. Wow, okay. You sound really important if that's your agenda. But if you say, I help lawyers organize information for really complex legal cases, now I just want to refer you to every lawyer that I know.
Right.
Well, actually, we usually work with firms with 200 or more lawyers. Oh, my friend works for a big law firm, but the other guys are solo practitioners. I'll introduce you to this guy. Now I'm able to actually make a useful referral for you. So you have to decide whether you want to sound complex and important or whether you want business. And most people choose complex and important because we're used to that. But if we take the jargon out and we tell someone else, and you can test this, right? Take your jargon-free, layman's terms job description. Tell your kid or somebody else you know who is like a decade younger than you and not in the same industry, tell them what you do, tell them to tell someone else, and then have that person tell you what you do. And if they get it wrong, you are too complicated.
Yeah.
If it can't survive a game of telephone with a bunch of 20-year-old college students, then fine. Even better if you can get it to go through a chain of high school kids. You don't have to get through 8-year-olds. They're gonna lose interest halfway through your sentence. If you can get it to go through kids, even better. That there's a reason that kids always say, I want to be a fireman, a teacher, a policeman, or an army man, or a doctor. Those are really easy to understand ideas, and they're a part of a kid's world. Data management solutions for litigation professionals is not part of anyone's world except for somebody in that world. So we have to realize, remember when you were a kid, those are the jobs you knew about. Then you got to high school and you knew about a few more, but not that many more. Then you got to college and you went, God, I got to figure out what to do with my life. But I still don't really know that many more jobs than I did when I was 12. So I guess I'm going to do something with this stuff that I'm studying. And then you get out in the working world and you go, holy crap, there are compliance officers. There's 8,000 different types of attorneys. I used to think lawyer was one job. Now it's 1,000. What's going on here? Your world expands, but you got to realize that for most people, they're still in their little niche. So you have to speak the language of that niche. And that would be point number four. Your job description has to generate referrals. And the way that it does has to be able to survive contact with people who are not in your industry.
Right.
And the fifth point, I think, would be, God, there's so many, but a good fifth point would be your first impressions are made non-verbally. And so a lot of people worry about things like what we talked about earlier in the show, which is, what do you say to start a conversation? The answer is, it doesn't really matter, which doesn't help if you're like, well, shit, I'm still shy. Thanks, Jordan. The problem is that your first impression is made before you open your mouth. And if you don't believe me, you can test this. Go walk down Howard right now or through a mall and you'll be like, oh, attractive person, overweight person, scary looking person. And then you'll see somebody with tattoos all over their face and you'll go, oh my gosh, whoa, that person looks great. Like, wow, that's prison time right there. You're making these little judgments about people. Even if you think, I am not a judgy person. I vote Democrat and I treat everyone equally or whatever. You still make survival based judgments.
Sure.
Like a child is not threatening.
Yeah.
A 350 pound person who's of a different ethnicity than you is going to look more threatening than an 8-year-old. It's just facts. And we make these judgments all the time. Someone who's well-dressed, you might leave your laptop next to them in a cafe. Somebody who has tattoos on their face and has a gold chain around their neck, you might take your laptop with you to the bathroom, or you might tell the other person to keep an eye on it and not them. You're making these value judgments.
Yeah. So what do you recommend there?
I recommend that the earlier point is not to become less judgmental. The point is to realize that other people are judging you in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people think, I'm going to turn on my nonverbal communication the second I go into this mixer. I got a networking event I got to go to. I'm going to stand up straight. I'm going to smile. I'm going to look confident. And then it looks unnatural and they're not present because they're trying to micromanage their body language. So they end up trying to have a conversation. And if they pay attention to the conversation, they revert back into computer mode, hunched over, shoulders rounded. Or they're like, all right, I'm rounded up. I'm smiling. I'm paying attention. Oh, wait, crap. What's Kevin talking about? Shoot, I lost the last 30 seconds. Hang on a second. Oh, wait, no, smile. Sit up straight. Shit, what's going on?
Right.
You can't do that. You got to delegate it to the level of habit. The way that we do this is if you sit up nice and tall, you got your chest up, your chin up, smile on your face, open positive body language. You got to remember to keep your body like this. Easier said than done. So I like to hack my own psychology a la the kangaroo suit. We call this the doorway drill at the Art of Charm. Put up a post-it note, doesn't even have to say anything on it, at eye level in the door frame of your office door, your bathroom door, your room, in your house, whatever. Put that up at eye level. And what that will do is every time you walk through that doorway, you'll go, why is there a post? Oh, right. Straighten up, shoulders back, chest up.
So it becomes habit, basically.
Right, because you're going through those doors so many times per day, but that post-it note will start to become a pattern interrupt where you don't just walk through the door and not notice. You walk through and you go, oh, blank, oh, right, upright, upright. Okay, got it, reset. Then every time you walk into or out of a door, in theory, you should have a mental post-it note. So when you walk into that Starbucks, you walk into that mixer, you walk through that door, you reset your body language. If you reset your body language, it's going to become your default body language. You walk through so many doors every single day, so many. And if you're constantly resetting your body language every time you do, you will start to create a different first impression non-verbally among the people that are watching you. And if you look at a doorway, if you look at a room full of people, a lot of people are looking at the doorway to see who enters. It's probably some evolutionary psychology security thing happening here. But people will look at the doorway. So that's where their first impression of you happens. Not when you walk up and go, hey, sure is cold outside, eh? Like, that's not your first impression. Your first impression is made while you think you're building up liquid courage at the bar, while you think you're babysitting nachos at the event mixer, while you're on your BlackBerry huddled in the corner at the all hands meeting. Those are your first impressions for these other folks. So you really need to have that nonverbal down. That way it's habit. Then you can be present in your conversations and people will start to treat you differently because they're going to start to treat you in the way that you treat somebody who has upright, open, positive, confident, friendly body language instead of the closed off shy person or the computer hunched over person or the not present individual.
Yeah.
So once you start getting treated differently, you start to act in that way. If people treat you like a local celebrity, if you've ever lived in Asia, like Japan, and people are like, whoa, you start to feel like, oh, I'm a celebrity.
Right.
People are pointing at me because I'm white. So you start to be the gaijin You start to be a little bit more outgoing. You start to be confident looking at people or having people look at you and take pictures of you. You just get used to that in a place like Japan. That won't happen to you probably here in the States just for standing up straight, but people will treat you differently. And when they do and you start to act that way, that reinforces the cycle. People go, in fact, people that knew me when I was in law school or shortly thereafter, they treat me in a different way than people who met me a long time ago. And my college roommates say things like, wow, you are a totally different person now.
Hmm.
It is unbelievable. Because I used to be quiet, shy, maybe a little bit like negative because I was kind of angry about being shy. Felt like I was underappreciated or something like that, right? I just didn't, and I couldn't get out of it. It was like a baby who couldn't communicate, just cry. So my college roommates are like, wow, this is a huge change. When I tell people that I've met a few years later after working on this process, I say things like, yeah, you know, it's funny because before law school I used to be such a weird, shy person. And they say things like, oh yeah, you were a shy person, huh? And I'm like, no, you don't understand. I really was. And they go, look, you probably think that because maybe you were more shy than you are now, but you weren't shy. And I think, yes, I was shy. You don't get it. And they refuse to believe it because their first impression was, you're not shy.
Right.
They decided that. That happened. Now I'm not shy. It takes a long time for other people's first impressions to be corrected. Luckily, it can happen over time, but it takes so long. So you really have to be careful what your first impression is.
Yeah.
And
what do you think in terms of like wardrobe too? Like for me, I've always been like today, black t-shirt.
We're wearing like the exact same
jeans, you know, sneakers. Like the thing for me is, you know, I still think about this as well, because if you look at, if you just were to see me on the street, like I'm wearing a baseball cap right now, like certainly don't look professional. And I've never been a suit wearing type of person, but I've thought of, and I've found little tiny tweaks in that, like sometimes like if I'm going to, I mean, this is a total cheat, but like if I'm going out to someplace a little bit nicer, like I'll still wear my t-shirt, but I'll throw on like a scarf, like a nice scarf or something.
Yeah.
Just like one little thing that makes it look like I'm trying a little bit more so than just being super ultra casual Saturday.
Yeah.
Like, do you find that like you have to dress a certain way to change people's like first impressions, or like what do you do there if you're a really casual geeky person?
Good question. I think that the way you do it now actually makes perfect sense. Bearing in mind that we're in Silicon Valley and it's normal, right? Like you can wear a hoodie to a meeting if you're doing venture capital and the person pitching you has to wear a suit. That them's the rules, theoretically, right? But if you want to dress up a little and you add a scarf, fine, fair enough. If you really want to go all out, you could leave the hat and comb your hair. I know, but I'm talking extreme formality, right?
Yeah.
You could do that, or you could shave or something like that. But if you're on Wall Street, you're really trying to dress for the type of event. So I would say here, being super casual is fine. And looking like you're trying a little bit more is a notch up and it's visible, but it's also cultural and geographic.
Right.
If you're in New York,
you can't go too far because then all of a sudden you look like you're standing out in an awkward way, right?
Right. Bear in mind, the higher your status, the more you're allowed to stand out and fight cultural convention and get away with it. So if I'm meeting with Mark Zuckerberg and he's in running shorts and Vibram five finger shoes and a tank top, I don't get to say, this guy, how dare you, right? I better damn well show up in a suit and not care. His status is much higher than me when I'm asking him for money or something like this, or trying to apply for a job.
So, I don't think he'd care that you had a suit on. I think he'd probably prefer you in a hoodie.
He probably would, but he would also, and other people in the room might go, these guys don't take it seriously.
Right.
Right. So you have to dress for the type of crowd, and it's heavily dependent on your status too. So
do you recommend that people that have like no clue in this, like you're like, you called yourself a nerd. I was definitely a nerd back in the day. You know, do you hire like someone to go out and like help you buy clothes? Like, is it like,
yeah, I didn't hire anyone at first. What I did was meet different stylish women that I was friends with that were like way out of my league generally. Mm-hmm. And I would say something like, after befriending them for a while, I would say, hey, look,
take me shopping?
Can you take me shopping?
Really? You see,
they would
that.
Go, yeah, I would love to do that. Oh my God. I thought you would never ask. Or like only on the condition that I can throw out everything I've ever seen you wear.
Right.
And we can replace
it. That's how
it.
You know it's bad.
Yeah. And yeah. I remember people saying things like that. And I'd be like, what? This is my cool purple shirt. And they're like, no, it doesn't fit well. It's totally like five seasons ago. And you look like a tool. But you're really nice. And that's why I like you. And I'm not friends with you because of the purple shirt.
Right.
I'm friends with you in spite of the purple shirt. I mean, I dealt with stuff like that all the time.
Yeah.
And I would go out and buy things with them that looked a little bit outside my comfort zone, but weren't ridiculous. Like I didn't have jeans where the entire front was torn off. I just bought clothes right. that fit well and looked fine. And then I'd get used to that. And then gradually I'd be able to pick my own stuff. And then gradually I'd be able to do this really well. And that was a huge help. A lot of if you're listening to this right now and you feel like you can't dress well, and you don't have a significant other that will take you shopping.
Yeah.
Every wife wants to get rid of some crap that her husband owns. I'm sure you're very familiar with this.
Yeah.
And I'm sure things disappear here and there. And you're just like, hey, what happened to that? Oh, wait, I know better than to ask. But a lot of you guys listening right now and a lot of you ladies listening right now should probably take somebody up on this. The women are like, yes, I really hope so-and-so asks me to take him shopping. Or women might go, I hate this. I'm the one woman I know who doesn't like to do this. That's fine. You can meet somebody who's really into fashion. You can even just go to a store and you can have them help you. Just bear in mind, if they work on commission, you're going to get different. The incentives are not necessarily aligned as such. But there are services where you can hire someone to do this. It's not that expensive to have somebody go and help you buy things. Usually you can find someone to do it for free.
Yeah.
And you don't have to go out and buy an Armani suit. Chances are you just need to buy pants that fit.
Right.
You could take things to a tailor if they don't, and you don't want to get rid of them. You need t-shirts that fit. You need button downs, one or two that fit. You don't need 20 outfits that look awesome. You need one or two that look good. That's it.
The thing for me that I always found that was helpful that I finally embraced was that, you know, we all kind of know, and you see people walking down the street that are super stylish, right?
Yes.
And I remember when skinny jeans first came out, and I was still wearing the pretty baggy, like jeans.
I know. I was just thinking about
and
that today.
And I looked at the skinny jeans, and I was like, no way in hell you're going to get me in those things, right? And so I remember eventually what happened is I thought, okay, I know where the extreme is here, like the ultra skinny, like you can see someone's like
vacuum sealed.
Yeah, vacuum sealed. And I know where I am today. Clearly where I am today, and I don't mean today, I mean this is a few years ago, was too much on the side of 1995, right? Like I needed to update a little bit. And I think a good way is to kind of like ease your way in and like just go a little couple more steps a little bit out of your comfort zone, but not to the point where you're going to be like embarrassed when you're walking around because it doesn't feel right for you.
That is absolutely correct. If you're outside your comfort zone, it should be in the way where you go, wow, I feel like I'm a little bit more fashionable than usual. This is pretty cool.
Right.
You don't want to be outside your comfort zone in the way where you go, oh my God, I feel like I have a wedgie. Everyone can see my package.
Right.
I feel like these are too tight. I know I look bad in these. I looked in the mirror. I feel fat. I feel like these are vacuum sealed. I hate this jacket. It's itchy. That's worse.
It's a waste of money too, because then you never wear the stuff.
You never
wear it. I've done that a bunch of times. And like, you have like those five things in the closet. You're like, oh, this looks so cool. It's hanging there in the closet, but I could never wear them, you know?
Yeah. Oh,
it's so funny.
Absolutely. Not only that, but the purpose of the clothing isn't necessarily to get people to say that person's fashionable. It's to get you to feel like, oh, all right, I'm on the edge of this, or I'm in this area where I blend in a way that's positive, or I'm making the right kind of statement. You're not peacocking. You're not getting like, hey, look at me. I got a up necklace. Like you don't want that.
Yeah.
We're talking about, you're trying to get to equilibrium from just maybe a negative.
And not stay stuck in a certain, you know, like decade. Like that can happen to a lot of people. You just get stuck in this, I've worn these since the 90s, and like you continue to wear that stuff.
Look at these things are still in great condition.
Right.
Does not matter.
So I don't want to take it too much more of your time. I'm curious, where can people find you? Like the Art of Charm is where you can learn a lot of this stuff. I've been listening to your podcast for, I'd say about a year or so now is when I first started learning to it. And you've had some great guests on there. So you would say just subscribe to the podcast. Do you have a newsletter or anything like that?
Yeah, we have a newsletter, and it's sort of a roundup of the shows. We also offer drills and stuff on there, like the ones I taught today. But I would say, look, I'm not trying to sell anybody on anything other than you already listened to a podcast. If you got room for one more in the rotation, I would love to earn your earballs. There's no ring to that. Your earballs, your ears.
I don't think it's balls.
Because eyeballs, you know, get eyeballs on something, earballs. There's definitely no balls in there.
Yeah, that's right.
Unlike your skinny jeans. Yeah. But I would love to earn your attention in a positive way if people want to check out The Art of Charm.
Yeah, we'll link to it in the show notes as well. But I mean, I love that you seem to be like a lifetime learner. Like,
oh, yeah, man.
And it's like something that I think is so important for people to realize that they don't have to be stuck, that there's always new tips and tricks and ways to improve ourselves, which I'm a big fan of. What, real quick, before we get kicked out, what are you still trying to learn? Like, what are you having? Do you go do coaching and things like that?
Oh, yeah, man. I have a couple broadcasting coaches that teach me how to interview better, show up on the mic a little better. I've got a voice coach that helps me build stamina in my voice, resonance, all these little things that singers do because if you listen to early episodes, I'm like, hey guys, what's going on? Yeah. I'm just doing this talk show.
I'm going to go back and listen to episode one.
Do it. You can tell, like, you can hear the work and people go, oh, well, you know, part of it's talent. You have a voice for this. That voice is not there 11 years ago.
Yeah.
There's work. I'd put a literal cork in my mouth and talk every morning and build up, stretch out the palate and all this weird stuff that I have to do dumb things in the mirror for, like, you know, stupid things that you're like, like all that stuff.
You do all the singing stuff?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's weird.
Did you do that before you came on the show today?
No, I forgot. But I did talk in the car. Yeah, you can tell. But your palate did sound a little tight, Jordan.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Exactly.
I took improv classes because a lot of guests that I interview might be comedians. I got to be as quick as them.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you're taking this seriously.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And that's just for the podcasting and interview stuff. I also learned Mandarin Chinese. I've been doing that for 5 years. Man, I'm learning a lot of stuff. My hobby is learning about Russia and stuff like that. The voice stuff for the show, audio broadcasting was something I learned a while ago. Now I outsource a lot of that to the Jasons and the guys that help us produce our shows here, you and I both. And I've recently tried to bring on, I'm still working on this, bring on somebody who works at NPR to help me craft narrative arcs.
Oh, man.
It's so complex.
Those are such beautiful podcasts when you listen to them. And you're just like, you know, there's a team of people behind the scenes, like cutting that together.
And you know, I know I can't do it.
Yeah.
I'm like, just don't have my head wrapped around it.
You really need a producer to come in and just kind of run that whole thing.
Yeah.
If you could hire someone away, that would be so key because those shows are just awesome.
Well, I want to learn the science, the art behind it.
The storytelling piece.
So that I can bring it into my interviews. And then, in a couple of years, I might go, hey, look, this is someone's full-time job to take all these clips and do this. Because Jason does a really good job.
We're talking about our editor. We both use the same guy.
Yeah, Jason DeFilippo. He does a really good job moving things around in your show and my show and making it right. And when we do the shows together live, he's on Slack like, hey, do this part, do that part. We're looking at the prep together. But NPR, those people, some of them are 20, 30 year veterans of interviewing somebody, and they know how to get great stories out of people.
Right.
Mine's a little clunky. I might say, tell me the story of how you found out that you were addicted to crack, you know? And whereas an NPR person can kind of like elicit the story and then get the emotion, and then there's a clip of, and I just can't do that.
Yeah. I feel like it's almost like a full time job.
Oh, it is.
Like it's almost separate than, exactly. That's the whole
and
thing.
And you and I are like, no, we're just going to talk for an hour.
Right.
Yeah.
So, okay. So where can people find you on social media?
At The Art of Charm on Twitter, at Jordan Harbinger on Instagram. I do not use Snapchat.
I don't either.
I'm on Facebook, but I've been told that it's full now and you can't even send a request.
Oh, to friend you. I thought it was full, like you couldn't sign up.
Sorry, all of Facebook
is full. Don't sign up.
If you don't have Facebook, they're all out of accounts.
That's right.
They have run out of pages.
That's funny.
Yeah, but what social media do you use?
I'm just, I would say Instagram sporadically. I use their stories more often. I was on Snap for a while, but I just kind of fell away from it.
Yeah.
I think that's, I don't really use my Facebook as much as I used to.
What about Twitter?
Twitter I do every once in a while, but it's mostly like more geeky talk.
Mm-hmm.
I do like, I tweet out my cryptocurrency stuff that I'm into and stuff like that.
So. Yeah, I hear you. I'm always looking at where can I maximize my time on this stuff. I like answering tweets because they are by definition short and they're a great way to engage with people who wouldn't like write you an email.
Yeah.
I do answer all my email, Jordan@JordanHarbinger.com for people who are like, I have something only for you.
Oh, dude, tell me your since we've mentioned crypto like five times, give me your top five coins to finish us out.
Yeah, sure. Now I'm like,
I know this has nothing to do with what we were.
It doesn't have anything to do
talking
with it,
about,
but that's okay. I invested in OMG a while back because I think they have a really aggressive team, especially in Asia. That turned out to be pretty good as of the date of this recording, the morning of. I love Monero and Verge and privacy coins because I will always bet on people buying illegal shit on the internet, hiding money and not wanting to pay taxes.
Right.
And I'm not encouraging that behavior at all, but I am saying.
But you do two of the three.
There's always, and I won't tell you which two.
That's right.
But like, there's always going to be people who go, wait a minute, I don't want to be tracked. I mean, the whole Bitcoin
thing
was like all these privacy geeks. And yet, look, if you've got a powerful enough computer and enough time on your hands, you can track all that stuff. Sure, coin tumble it. Wait till the NSA, if they haven't already, finds out how to just infographic trace all that crypto that you've had for so long. Monero just sort of erases that. So I like OMG and Monero for that reason. I like crowdsourced information because it's really potent to have people competing to give information to places. So I like things like Syndicator, which also turned out to be a really good bet. Things that surprise me though, look, Bitcoin's always going to be, or quote unquote, air quotes, always going to be good. Ethereum, really good platform. There's so many new ones that I don't even have my mind wrapped around yet with like, it's like Ethereum, but it's faster.
Right.
I feel like that may or may not be true because they're going to figure out ways to scale these platforms. And the way that they're working on Ethereum and things like that, it's always going to change. And so I do like those things. As for the fifth one, man, it's really hard for me to say because there's so many good ones. I'm trying not to just pick based on performance because there's all this irrational behavior. Like we like Bitcoin Cash because, or we like Litecoin because I can't afford a whole Bitcoin. I really think that's one of the reasons why things like that are popular. Right. There's people who go, oh, I got to get into this crypto stuff and I'm on Coinbase. Bitcoin and Ethereum are too expensive. I'm just going to buy Litecoin.
Oh, I've had friends of mine tell me that have no idea what they're talking about with the crypto.
Yeah.
They sign up and they're like, well, I can get to Litecoin. They're cheaper. And so I'm doing that.
Right.
And like you, what?
Yeah. It's like, well, are you sure? Because there's a lot of decimals after each one of these other options. So, but people's psychology, I'll tell you, that's one thing. It's probably a topic for another show. That's something that has cost me so much opportunity cost in terms in crypto is I'll look at fundamentals and I understand what I think is a reasonable amount about blockchain. And I'll go, these are really solid fundamentals. And people will go, yeah, but this other one is cool because they said it's going to basically have babies and create its own little version of the coin and you get a dividend. And I go, yeah, but that it's crap. People buy that thing like crazy.
Right.
This thing's going to have babies in my wallet. I want that one.
Right.
Yeah. The other one has a crowd platform and a great team and artificial intelligence. So they've got a lot of computing resources. There's a lot of talent. Yeah. But this one has babies when it's in your wallet.
Right.
And I'm like, oh my God, what's happening? And it's the dot-com bubble where people go, wait a minute. It's like digital flowers. Oh, this is going to be huge. And you go, no, well, there's this thing where you could store all your data online. You don't need your computer. And they go, yeah, but this one has digital flowers. I'm going to pick that one.
Yeah.
And you look like CryptoKitties.
CryptoKitties. Oh,
that's
man.
Popular because
did
why?
You buy a kitty or no?
No.
I didn't buy a kitty either.
I can't do it.
I wouldn't do it either.
No.
It's just like, I mean, that's going to be fun for like 2 weeks.
Yeah. It's going to be like Pokemon Go where you buy the stock and you go, oh, wait, that was terrible.
Right.
But there's so many people doing that. And there's no argument to be made that there's no money in stupid stuff like that. The problem is that's gambling.
Yeah, that's gambling.
That's
a crazy, like, you don't know what's going to happen. You might wake up tomorrow and it's like a 1/10 of the cost of what you paid for it.
Exactly. Like, and so that's why I look at things like privacy coins and I go, okay, it's gambling in that we don't know which privacy coins, if any, are going to come out.
But one will win, yes.
But one will win and it will probably supplant it'll be the currency of people who want to do a trade, don't trust each other, don't want to tell each other who they are, don't want anybody to find out about it. And that doesn't have to be illegal.
Right.
But even if it's only illegal things, that's a huge segment.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I use the Signal app to do encrypted communications with my friends. And half the time we're just talking about like where to go have lunch.
Yeah. Why do you do that? I noticed that.
Actually. Well, I like the fact that it's just totally off the grid and no one can ever peer into it. And I don't know, there's too much spying going on these days. And so I'm all for privacy.
I would love to talk more about that at some point.
We'll have to have a geekier show.
I agree.
That we can go deep on some of this stuff. That'd be fun.
I had a client where I was teaching him some negotiation tactics and some nonverbal and verbal communication skills. And he was in Burma. This is years ago. Four plus years ago. He's in Burma.
Burma's a war zone.
That's
what Rambo said.
That's what Rambo says. Yeah. Oh, it's like, it's not that bad now, but okay. actually, it depends where you are. But he was there doing business, and everybody he was around was kind of shady. He had to do a lot of business with the military, and then he kept getting deals sniped from under him. And so he started to think he was being watched. And I thought he was the most paranoid weirdo in the world. And so we started using silent phone. Have you ever heard of this?
No.
It was probably way before Signal, but it's extremely well done. And it was at the time like the de facto secure phone. And it would be, you'd pick this thing up, this app up, you'd load it up. It would only connect with people who had requested a connection with you. And then it would start the call and it would encrypt, and you'd have to wait a while for it to sort of synchronize. Then it would say, check this passphrase with the person on the other end of the line. And he'd go, hey, Jordan, does yours say bot screen Zoom microphone? And I'd go, yeah, it does. And I'd click yes. And I'd go, does yours say printer window car television? And he'd go, yeah. And then we'd hit the button, and then it would like connect us without white noise in the background. And there were plenty of times where our calls were interrupted, and it was like, silent phone has detected an intrusion inside your encrypted connection. Please try the call again. Press here to start.
What?
And we found out that I told him to test and see if he was being watched by having unencrypted, unsecured conversations about deals he wasn't going to do and meetings that he was going to have, and then go to the hotel and see if he spotted anybody at the meeting venue in the hotel that looked suspect. Sure enough, we ran this test a few times with the help of some of my military special forces and intelligence buddies to show us how to do tests like this. And sure enough, he would show up at the lobby of like the whatever hotel, and there'd be like security guys there, military guys there, cops and undercover people sitting near him. And he wasn't really going to have a meeting, but they would show up every time. And if he would show up unannounced, they wouldn't be there. So he found out they were actually tapping his phone. And he found out for sure that they were tapping his phone because he got a different business partner for a telecom deal. And his business partner said, hey, FYI, I know what the other side's going to ask because we've been listening to their phone conversations because I bribed the Interior Ministry security guards. God. And he goes, by the way, you're also on their list of people. They've been listening to you too. So he found out like undisputed that they were spying on
him. That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Snowden recommended Signal.
Yeah.
He said that it was his kind of favorite open source. Like,
Silent Phone is old. I don't even know if it still exists. Signal's fine now.
Sounds like a lot of work. Like,
yeah. It was
pretty Peacock, like having to do all that. You don't have to do that with Signal. You just connect and it works.
I think with Signal, you do it once with each person and they verify that that's the account.
You can. You can go in and show, like, I think there's like a little QR code or something we can compare.
Yeah.
But yeah, otherwise you can just start it and assume that it's going to be fine. So
there's so much to this. Another conversation for another day. Yeah, thanks, man.
Thanks for coming on the show.
You got it.
All right, that's it for this episode. One last favor to ask you, if you could head on over to the iTunes store, do a little search for The Kevin Rose Show, or you can actually do it within the official Apple iTunes podcasting app, and find my show and rate it 5 stars. That'll make sure that it gets recommended to more people, we'll get more people listening, and we'll have better guests on the show. So thank you so much for that, and as always, head on over to kevinrose.com for all the show notes and additional details. Be well.